by the unusual business practices they encountered in the West, which is precisely what an American businessman in Moscow discovered while talking to a rich Uzbek cotton trader about the pay-for-play K Street lobbyists in Washington. The Uzbek, an aspiring oligarch who was all too familiar with the dark practices of the Bratva, listened patiently to a long explanation about how corporate America uses lobbyists to get access to Congress. Then it was as if a light bulb went off. You mean you have firms with highly paid professionals who are paid to bribe congressmen? He asked. He couldn't get over it. He had spent years navigating the perilous world of Bratva protection rackets, and here the Americans had sanitized corruption, institutionalized it, and made it into part of the white-collar professional world. Not only was it legal, it was a highly paid profession. After decades carrying water for big oil, big pharma, and Wall Street, K Street lobbyists were ready, willing, and able to jump in bed with anyone who could write a big check, including Russians. Among the first wave of lobbyists willing to play ball with them was Jack Abramoff, a.k.a. Casino Jack, the notorious super lobbyist who wined and dined D.C.'s most pliable politicians, made deals all over town, and reaped huge paydays from casino-rich Indian tribes, which he spent in fancy restaurants and stadium skyboxes and golf trips to Scotland and the Pacific island of Saipan. Jack Abramoff worked in the margins and loved it. Abramoff eventually served more than 4 years for mail fraud, conspiracy to bribe public officials, and tax evasion, and was at the center of a pay-for-play scam that led to the conviction of 21 other people, including Republican Majority Leader Tom DeLay of Texas. A high point in the scandal came when DeLay and Abramoff took a 6-day trip to London and Moscow, played golf, and met Prime Minister Viktor Chernomyrdin, among other Russian leaders. Though Abramoff billed the trip to a client in the Pacific, the Commonwealth of the Northern Marianas, the money was really coming in from a shell company controlled by Russian oligarchs Marina Nevskaya and Alexander Kulakovsky of Naftasib, a huge Russian oil company. At one point, the two oligarchs said they wanted to contribute to DeLay. One of them even asked, what would happen if the DeLays woke up one morning and found a luxury car in front of their house? That would have been illegal, of course. It would have been bribery. Everyone concerned would have ended up in jail, so the car never came. Instead, a $1 million check mysteriously made its way to the U.S. Family Network, a DeLay slush fund. DeLay had initially opposed a foreign aid bill that would help the International Monetary Fund bail out Russia's weak economy. But after the $1 million check arrived, he had a change of heart, although he later denied the payment had influenced his vote. Other Russians joined in. Alpha, the multi-billion dollar Russian conglomerate, paid Barber Griffith and Rogers, the influential GOP lobbying firm, co-founded by former Mississippi Governor Haley Barber, nearly $2 million in lobbying fees. Barber Griffith also received $820,000 from a United Kingdom shell company called Foruper Limited, which had no assets or employees, but which the U.S. Justice Department was investigating for possible ties to Mogilevich. The Alpha Group has interests in oil and gas, commercial and investment banking, asset management, insurance, retail trade, telecommunications, water utilities, and special situation investments. In Congress, Representative Kurt Weldon, a Republican from Pennsylvania, began touting a Russian arms control group called the International Exchange Group, which, according to ProPublica, happened to employ the head of the FSB as well as the Russian Army's chief of staff. According to the Los Angeles Times, Weldon also helped round up 30 fellow congressmen for a dinner to honor the chairman of the ITERA International Energy Corporation, a Russian natural gas company. As it happened, Itera had agreed to pay $500,000 a year for public relations to a firm run by Weldon's daughter, then an inexperienced 29-year-old lobbyist. Itera was the intermediary that Firtash and Mogilevich pushed aside to move into the Russian-Ukraine energy trade. Whether it was lobbying or finding lawyers, the Russians went straight to the top, as they had since the early days in Brighton Beach. When David Begotten got busted in the Red Daisy gas tax scam, he took on as his attorney Mitchell Rogovin, the highly placed former special counsel to the CIA. When Bogatin's brother, Jacob, needed representation for his role in Mogilevich's YBM Magnex pump-and-dump scam, he hired Eric Sitarchuk, who later ended up representing Trump himself in a suit filed against him as owner of the Trump International Hotel in Washington. Bob Dole, the former Senate Majority Leader and 1996 Republican presidential nominee, accepted a $560,000 fee to help Russian billionaire Oleg Deripaska obtain a visa to visit the U.S., after Deripaska had been accused by rivals of bribery. Even William Sessions, director of the FBI from 1987 to 1993, was not above doing a complete about-face when it came to Russian organized crime. In 1997, after he returned to private practice, he traveled to Moscow and alerted the world to the horrifying dangers of the brutal Russian mafia. A few years later, however, Sessions had no qualms about taking on as a client a Ukrainian-born mobster whom the FBI had put on its 10 most wanted list. His name was Semyon Mogilevich. William Sessions is not related to Attorney General Jeff Sessions. He is, however, the father of Representative Pete Sessions, Republican, Texas, who, interestingly, given his father's representation of Russia's most powerful mafia boss, was one of the most vocal opponents in the House of Representatives of sanctions against Russia. It is worth pointing out that according to Canada's National Post, earlier, Mogilevich had hired another important figure in American law enforcement as his attorney, namely Richard Crane Jr., former head of the U.S. Justice Department's Organized Crime Strike Force for the Western United States. Still, Russia's relationship with Trump was unique. One measure of that was discovered by FBI agents who were on the trail of Vyacheslav Ivankov, but couldn't figure out where he lived. Ivankov was like a ghost to the FBI, said Gregory Stashuk, an investigator with the New York State Organized Crime Task Force. Ivankov, of course, had been spotted frequently at the Trump Taj Mahal in Atlantic City and was widely thought to be based with other Russian mobsters in Brighton Beach. But whenever the FBI was ready to pounce, he vanished. When they finally found him, he wasn't in Brooklyn at all. Instead, they discovered that the head of the Russian mafia lived in a luxury condo in Manhattan, at 721 Fifth Avenue, in fact, Trump Tower. Ivankov was eventually convicted of extortion and sentenced to 9.5 years in jail. Meanwhile, Russians continued to court Trump, even though his political prospects seemed middling at best. In 2000, with trickster Roger Stone as his strategist, Trump had made a stab at winning the presidential nomination on the Reform Party ticket, but dropped out when he found out that the Reform candidate, no matter who it was, would not make the cutoff for the presidential debates. For the most part, Trump was still relegated to the bin of novelty celebrity candidates, like professional wrestler turned governor of Minnesota, Jesse Ventura. Nevertheless, Trump had a unique resume for someone on a presidential track. By this time, his ties to Russian money stretched back more than 2 decades. When it came to laundering money, casinos and real estate were the vehicles of choice, and the Trump Taj Mahal in Atlantic City seemed to be a favorite destination for Russian mobsters, who frequently arrived in Ferraris and Rolls Royces with stacks of $100 bills. Trump's bankruptcies notwithstanding, the Trump Taj Mahal continued to operate in what is known as a prepackaged bankruptcy, in which Trump gave a 50% stake in the business to its bondholders in exchange for lowered interest rates and a longer payoff schedule. If money laundering was going on, the Taj seems to have done everything within its power to keep it secret. In 1998, the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, FinCEN, assessed a $477,700 civil penalty against the Trump Taj Mahal for currency transaction reporting violations, namely, failing to report each time a gambler cashed out with more than $10,000 in a single day. FinCEN added that the casino admitted to willful and repeated Bank Secrecy Act violations, including violations of AML anti-money laundering program requirements, reporting obligations, and record-keeping requirements. But that didn't tell the whole story. At a time when it was very much the preferred spot of the Brighton Beach Mafia, the Taj Mahal was also short on cash, on the verge of bankruptcy, and not likely to cause trouble for such a free-spending clientele. Modest, though it was, at the time, FinCEN's fine was the biggest in history by the federal government for violating the Bank Secrecy Act. Moreover, it represented no fewer than 106 violations of the act, all of which left key questions unanswered. How much was laundered is unknown. In addition, as CNN reported, the names of parties suspected of money laundering had been scrubbed from the report, as were the identities of Trump employees involved in the transactions. Trump Taj Mahal received many warnings about its deficiencies, said FinCEN director Jennifer Shasky Calvary. Like all casinos in this country, Trump Taj Mahal has a duty to help protect our financial system from being exploited by criminals, terrorists, and other bad actors. Far from meeting these expectations, poor compliance practices over many years left the casino and our financial system unacceptably exposed. As the Russians knew, real estate was a far more efficient way to launder billions in flight capital, and Trump's newest projects were perfectly suited to their needs. In 1999, when the Russian economy was in a tailspin and scores of oligarchs were looking for a safe haven, construction was already underway on Trump's biggest project yet. Rising to 72 stories in Midtown Manhattan, Trump World Tower, overlooking the United Nations, was touted as the tallest residential building on the planet. Before long, one-third of the units on the tower's highest and priciest floors, floors 76 to 83, had been snatched up, either by individual buyers from the former Soviet Union or by limited liability companies connected to Russia or countries that had been part of the Soviet Union. "We had big buyers from Russia and Ukraine and Kazakhstan," sales agent Deborah Stotz told Bloomberg Businessweek. Ukrainian billionaire Semyon Sam Kislin assisted the sales effort by issuing mortgages to buyers of Trump's latest luxury condos. Among the new tenants was Eduard Nektalov, a diamond dealer from Uzbekistan who had bought a condo on the 79th floor of Trump World Tower, directly below Trump's future campaign manager, Kellyanne Conway. As with other buildings he developed, Trump deliberately mislabeled the floors in Trump World Tower to make it seem higher. As a result, it was possible for Eduard Nektalov to live on the 79th floor of the 72-story Trump World Tower. According to the Washington Post, the Conways caught Trump's attention during a condo board battle in which various residents wanted Trump's name stripped from the building's exterior. George Conway was one of the pro-Trump leaders, and his wife, Kellyanne, took a seat on the condo board and became friendly with Trump as a result. Like so many Trump associates, Kellyanne was not without ties to the mafia. According to the New York Daily News, her late grandfather, Jimmy the Brute Di Natale, was described by law enforcement authorities as a significant criminal associate of Nicodemo Little Nicky Scarfo, the heir apparent to a Philadelphia-based crime family. With his multi-million-dollar condo and a $300,000 Bentley, Nektalov, who was related to Lev Leviev, the billionaire pal of Putin's, known as the King of Diamonds, had been making a good living in the diamond world, but now he was being investigated by a Treasury Department task force for mob-connected money laundering. He and his father, Roman Nektalov, had been targeted in Operation Meltdown, a 2.5-year sting operation that uncovered a scheme through which diamond merchants laundered $8 million in Colombian drug proceeds. On a pleasant evening in May 2004, after reports circulated that he might soon start cooperating with federal investigators, Nektalov closed his store in New York's 47th Street Diamond District and began walking to the garage where he kept his Bentley. When he neared 48th Street, a long-haired man pulled a .45 out of his pants and fired once in the back of Nektalov's head. Nektalov collapsed. Then the shooter pumped two more bullets into his back and fled. Everybody on 47th Street knew if you had stolen stuff, you could bring it to the Nektalovs, said David Rybakov, a fellow Uzbek and a veteran of the Diamond District. I knew someday something was going to happen with these people. If you play with fire, you're going to get burned. This was Trump's market. Early on, Trump came to the conclusion that it is better to do business with crooks than with honest people, said Anders Oslund, a Swedish economist and senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. Crooks have two big advantages. First, they're prepared to pay more money than honest people. And second, they will always lose if you sue them because they are known to be crooks. All Trump needed to do, it seemed, was slap his name on a big building, preferably in gigantic, bold, brass, uppercase lettering, and high-dollar customers from Russia and the former Soviet republics were guaranteed to come rushing in, gangland shootouts among his residents notwithstanding. After Trump World Tower opened, Sotheby's International Realty teamed up with a Russian real estate company to make a big sales push for the property in Russia. Dolly Lenz, a New York real estate broker, spoke to USA Today. I had contacts in Moscow looking to invest in the United States, Lenz said. They all wanted to meet Donald. In the end, she said that she sold some 65 units in Trump World Tower to Russians. There was one more factor that helped Trump evolve toward a new business model. Disastrous as his Atlantic City bankruptcies had been, one serendipity had come out of the experience. Banks that were on the hook for his gigantic losses decided that the Trump name had real market value. This was not merely the wishful fantasy of an egomaniacal once-and-future billionaire. Ironically, the fact that he was so overextended worked to his benefit when the real estate market collapsed, said Stephen Bollenbach, a corporate salvage specialist who helped structure Trump's Atlantic City rescue operation. He already had his financing. They were stuck with him. Bollenbach's epiphany came after a cash-strapped Trump failed to make an $800,000 quarterly insurance payment for his prized yacht, the Trump Princess, and assumed the bank would seize the boat. But Bollenbach had argued to the bank that the yacht was more valuable as the Trump Princess than as just another big boat, and to his astonishment, the bank agreed. They even paid the insurance premium. That meant the banks realized they were in better shape if Trump was back in business. It also meant that Trump could implement a completely new business model that allowed him to stay in real estate without having to deal with the onerous chores of financing and of actually being the developer. The model was simple. Because his name had brand value, he would license it to developers who would do all the work and give him a piece of the action. Then he would sit back and collect royalties, which were often 18% or more. It was also the perfect solution for both Trump and the Russians. On the one hand, Russians had billions of dollars from illicit sources that needed to be laundered. On the other hand, Trump, who was in dire need of financing, had the ideal vehicles for laundering their money, real estate and casinos, and a history of not asking too many questions of his buyers. To capitalize on this new business model, Trump struck a deal with a Florida developer to attach his name to three high-rises in Sunny Isles Beach, just outside Miami. Without putting up a dime of his own money, Trump would receive a cut of the profits. "Russians love the Trump brand," Sunny Isles developer Gil Deeser told Bloomberg. A local broker added that one-third of the 500 apartments he'd sold went to Russian speakers. So many bought the Trump-branded apartments, in fact, that the area became known as Little Moscow. Many of the units were sold by a native of Uzbekistan who had emigrated from the Soviet Union in the 1980s. Her business was so brisk that she soon began bringing Russian tour groups to Sunny Isles to view the properties. According to a Reuters investigation, at least 63 buyers with Russian addresses or passports spent $98 million on Trump's properties in South Florida. What's more, one-third of the units, more than 700 in all, were bought by shell companies that concealed the true owners. And over the next few years, roughly 20% of Trump-branded condos, more than 1,300 luxury condos in all, repeatedly went to anonymous shell companies. Far from being a comprehensive tally, this number represents a conservative estimate of the amount of Russian flight capital that came through Trump property in the late 90s alone, $1.5 billion. The estimate comes from a BuzzFeed investigation that concluded that more than 1,300 of Trump's 6,400 condos sold in the U.S. had the characteristics of money laundering deals, all cash, bought through a shell company. The condo sold for an average of $1.2 million. And mind you, that $1.5 billion refers only to the sale of Trump condos in the United States. It does not include his buildings in Turkey, Panama, the Philippines, India, Toronto, Baku, or elsewhere. A key part of the model was that Trump appears to have defined his target market as Russian money. Trump specifically marketed his Sunny Isles, Florida apartment units in Moscow, St. Petersburg, and other venues designed to attract Russian organized crime money, said Kenneth McCallion, a former federal prosecutor and New York attorney who specializes in human rights, money laundering, and civil racketeering cases. A Reuters investigation did not find any wrongdoing by Trump or his real estate organization. In response to media inquiries, Trump Organization lawyer Alan Garten commented that the firm did not track nationalities of buyers and that the company rarely plays a role in recruiting buyers. However, the dubious character of Trump's clientele was so obvious that the Financial Times suggested that the Russian-American Chamber of Commerce, headed by Sergey Milyan, who claimed to be Trump's exclusive broker for Trump properties in Russia and the former Soviet Union, was the kind of Russian operation that harkened back to Cold War-style espionage. Konstantin Boravoy, who was president of Russia's first commodities exchange, agrees that Milyan's Chamber of Commerce is reminiscent of the kind of practices one saw from the secret services at the height of the Cold War. "These institutions have been revived and developed," he said. "The Chamber of Commerce institutions are the visible part of the agent network. Russia has spent huge amounts of money on this." In Moscow, of course, since the demise of the Soviet Union, the KGB had been replaced by the FSB, but that did not mean its vaunted tradecraft had been lost or in any way diminished. To the contrary, the Kremlin was now being run by a career KGB operative, in fact one whose life's goal was to revive Russia's shattered dreams of empire. To that end, at almost every turn, there is evidence of the Russians throwing the KGB textbook at Trump, trying to entangle him and compromise him in as many ways as possible. And in Trump, the Russians seem to have found the perfect mark. As Comrade Kruchkov's notebooks had made clear, the KGB wanted to know about the level of subject's truthfulness and sincerity. Is he hypocritical in double-dealing? They wanted to know about compromising information regarding the subject, including illegal acts in financial and commercial affairs, intrigue, speculation, bribes, graft, trading in narcotics, and exploitation of his position to enrich himself. They wanted to know if pride, arrogance, egoism, ambition, or vanity were among the subject's natural characteristics. Then there was the question of the subject's relationships with women. Is he secretly fascinated by them? Is he in the habit of having affairs with women on the side? By this time, of course, Russian intelligence already knew exactly where Trump fit in terms of such questions. According to Oleg Kalugin, Trump likely had his first taste of sexual kompromat in 1987. There were similar reports, unconfirmed, about possible comparable incidents in 1996. And then there was the fact that after years of promoting himself as a billionaire, Trump was still anathema to Western banks and was desperate to climb back to the top of the heap. Using his name as a brand was an inspired idea, but it was coupled with his apparent eagerness to turn a blind eye to practices that allowed the Russian mob to launder money through his real estate on a massive scale. Getting to that level, however, required a third party, not unlike Bayrock Group LLC, a real estate firm that was largely staffed, owned, and financed by emigres from Russia and the former Soviet Union, and had moved into the 24th floor of Trump Tower. With its ties to the Kremlin, Russian intelligence, and possibly the mob, Bayrock's looming presence in Trump Tower should have had American counterintelligence agents on high alert. To Russian operatives, one can only imagine, Trump was such easy prey. Chapter 12. International Man of Mystery. Whatever the Russians may have thought about Trump, when the ratings came in for the last week of the 2004 TV season, American television viewers clearly had a very different opinion. The final episode of The Apprentice, Donald Trump's wildly successful new show on NBC, had been seen by an estimated 28 million viewers and ranked as the number one show of the week. It was the most popular new show of 2004. To outside appearances, Trump was back on top after his failures in Atlantic City. Earlier that year, he had launched the new show in typical Trumpian fashion. "My name's Donald Trump," he had declared in his opening narration for The Apprentice, "the largest real estate developer in New York. I own buildings all over the place. Model agencies, the Miss Universe pageant, jetliners, golf courses, casinos, and private resorts like Mar-a-Lago, one of the most spectacular estates anywhere in the world." But it wouldn't be Trump without a better story than that. "It wasn't always so easy," he confessed, over images of his cruising around New York in a stretch limo. "About 13 years ago, I was seriously in trouble. I was billions of dollars in debt. But I fought back and I won. Big league. I used my brain. I used my negotiating skills. And I worked it all out. Now my company's bigger than it ever was and stronger than it ever was. I've mastered the art of the deal." The show, which reportedly paid Trump up to $3 million per episode, instantly revived his brand. The Apprentice turned Trump from a blowhard Richie Rich who had just gone through his most difficult decade into an unlikely symbol of straight talk, an evangelist for the American gospel of success, a decider who insisted on standards in a country that had somehow slipped into handing out trophies for just showing up. Journalists Michael Cranish and Mark Fisher observe in their book, Trump Revealed. Above all, Apprentice sold an image of the host boss as supremely competent and confident, dispensing his authority and getting immediate results. The analogy to politics was palpable. Unfortunately, much of what Trump said simply wasn't true. He wasn't the biggest developer in New York, the New York Times pointed out. Nor did he own the Trump International Hotel and Tower at New York's Columbus Circle, which was featured in his promo. Nevertheless, there was no denying that he was back. Critics derided his show as a cheesy, Vegas-like caricature of what business was really like. But The Apprentice was a huge hit and provided a primetime platform that Trump used to further enhance his brand and to unveil another big project. Over time, ratings sagged, but the show was still a powerful marketing tool for Trump. On the 2006 season finale of The Apprentice, as more than 11 million viewers waited to learn which of the two finalists was going to be fired, Trump prolonged the suspense by cutting to a promotional video for his latest venture. Located in the center of Manhattan's chic artist enclave, the Trump International Hotel and Tower in Soho is the site of my latest development, he narrated over swooping helicopter footage of Lower Manhattan. The new building, he added, would be nothing less than a $370 million work of art, an awe-inspiring masterpiece. What Trump didn't say in the video was that Trump Soho was the brainchild of two development companies, Bayrock Group, LLC, and the Sapir Organization, run by a pair of wealthy émigrés from the former Soviet Union who had done business with some of Russia's richest and most notorious oligarchs. Together, their firms had made Trump an offer he couldn't refuse. The developers would license Donald Trump's name for branded luxury high-rises Bayrock would finance and develop. Without a financial investment, Trump was back in action, Phoenix-like, with his name on yet another gleaming luxury hotel condominium development. In return for lending his name to the project, Trump would get an 18% equity stake. In the wake of his massive debts and multiple bankruptcies, Wall Street had said no to Trump. The banks had said no to Trump. New York had said no to Trump. But Bayrock had said yes, and thanks to them, Donald Trump was back in business. No one at Bayrock was more important in working with Trump than Felix Sater, its managing director. One of the most enigmatic figures in the entire Trump-Russia saga, Sater was Bayrock's international man of mystery, a stocky, olive-complexioned, Porsche-driving super salesman straight out of Glengarry Glen Ross, who was always on, pushing a pump-and-dump stock scam or going undercover for the CIA, the DIA, the FBI, whomever, to try to buy Stinger missiles from Al-Qaeda or undertake other mind-boggling feats of derring-do. Born in Moscow, Felix had come to the United States with his family, then known as the Shefirovskys, in the early 70s, when he was a young boy, and settled with the first waves of Soviet émigrés in Brighton Beach's Little Odessa. They left Russia with few regrets. According to Howard Rosenberg, a producer at CBS's 60 Minutes, who interviewed Sater, Felix's father, Mikhail Shefirovsky, is said to have watched the communists execute his father, Felix's grandfather, in the courtyard of their apartment building. Sater's father is most frequently referred to in the press by the name Shefirovsky, but there are many conflicting spellings of his real name. According to an article by Vladimir Kozlovsky for BBC's Russian service, the real family name in Russia was actually Setyorov. As for Felix, court documents show that he also went by the names of Sater, Slater, Sader, Chaim F. Sater, Hai Ying Sater, and his putative birth name of Shefirovsky. There long have been allegations that Mikhail Shefirovsky had ties to organized crime, including Mogilevich, but much of his past is shrouded in mystery. Sater's attorney, Robert S. Wolfe, told me in an email that Shefirovsky never met nor had anything to do with Semyon Mogilevich. Mikhail Sater, Shefirovsky, has never been a named accomplice of Semyon Mogilevich, nor are there any court documents that so indicate. This is a complete fabrication. Nevertheless, according to a certified U.S. Supreme Court petition, Felix Sater's FBI handler described Felix's father, Michael Shefirovsky, a.k.a. Mikhail Sater, as a Semyon Mogilevich crime syndicate boss. Exactly what that meant was not defined. As Richard Lerner, the lawyer who wrote the Supreme Court petition, explained, the Russian mafia doesn't exactly hand out business cards. Shefirovsky's ties to the Italian mob were more clear-cut. After he got to Brighton Beach, Shefirovsky partnered in various extortion scams with Ernest Butch Montevecchi, a soldier in the Genovese crime family, which had joined with the Russian mafia in the Red Daisy gasoline tax scam in the 80s and had been represented by Roy Cohn. Shefirovsky made the rounds of his victims accompanied by a 6'9", 300-pound giant nicknamed King Kong, whose intimidating presence could be rather persuasive. In 2000, Shefirovsky pleaded guilty to charges that he ran an extortion ring that targeted grocery stores, restaurants, and other establishments. His son Felix grew up near Brighton Beach and as a teenager counted among his friends Michael D. Cohen, who later became President Trump's personal attorney. At the time, Cohen was dating Laura Schusterman, a Ukrainian girl Sater knew and whom Cohen later married, but the two men came from distinctly different worlds. Sater's Brighton Beach, Coney Island neighborhood, of course, had its rough spots. I was one of the white kids on the block, which led to lots of beatings, he told Talking Points Memo. By contrast, Cohen lived in the tonier, more suburban precincts of Long Island's five towns in Nassau County. Sater took classes at Pace University but dropped out, and before long was a Wall Street hotshot, working at shops like Bear Stearns and Shearson Lehman Brothers. A charismatic but volatile man and an unrelenting salesman, Felix, then in his mid-twenties, loved the high life. He collected expensive watches and thought nothing of going into Ermenegildo Zegna and spending $30,000 on suits. Felix's father had wanted his son to go straight, but as his friend Salvatore Lauria put it in his autobiography, The Scorpion and the Frog, Felix would rather go through the back door than the front door of any deal. In an email to the author, Sater's attorney, Robert S. Wolfe, disputed allegations made in The Scorpion and the Frog and asserted that it was a work of fiction and that Mr. Sater was not a character in the book. However, David S. Barry, the book's co-author, has said the book is entirely factual, and its publisher, New Millennium, has marketed the book as nonfiction. Sater also had a quick temper, and on October 1, 1991, when he was having drinks at a bar in Midtown Manhattan, he got into a fight over a girl. Intoxicated and inebriated as a result of excessive drinking, according to court records, Sater grabbed a margarita glass, broke it on the bar, and smashed the stem into his foe's face. Then, according to the trial transcript, Sater picked up another piece of broken glass and lunged at the victim's friend. "I'm going to kill you, motherfucker," he said. "You faggot. Your mother's a whore. Some black nigger fucked your mother." The man's injuries required 110 stitches. Sater was convicted of felony assault, served a 15-month sentence, and was barred from legally selling securities. "I had great plans for myself, which were all shattered with that stupid drunken night in a bar," Felix later told ABC. But that wasn't the end of it. Even though Sater had lost his license to trade stocks, in 1993, he and two associates got control of White Rock Partners, a brokerage firm that later changed its name to State Street Capital Markets. Felix had rented a penthouse office suite at 40 Wall Street, a 71-story neo-Gothic skyscraper in downtown Manhattan, owned by Donald Trump. According to the New York Times, the three men secretly used offshore accounts to gain control of large blocks of penny stocks in four companies so they could inflate the value of the shares. Once the price went up, Sater and his friends sold the stocks at a steep profit in an illegal pump-and-dump scheme that left ordinary investors holding the bag when prices collapsed and was somewhat similar to Mogilevich's YBM Magnex scam. With the help of Sater's father, the firm got protection from the Genovese family, and Sater used an alias, Paul Stewart, to launder the proceeds through a network of Caribbean shell companies, Swiss and Israeli banks, and associates in New York's Diamond District. In the end, it was a mob operation that ended up cheating unsuspecting investors out of $40 million. Then, in 1995, everything changed for Sater. He quit the business because, he told BuzzFeed, he didn't want to do dirty shit anymore. Before long, Sater was given an opportunity to take part in a telecommunications deal for AT&T in Russia. And while he was there, he entered the world of espionage. It happened one night in Moscow when an American defense contractor named Milton Blaine, Blaine died in 2016, noticed Sater dining with high-level Russian intelligence agents, got his number, and set up a meeting for the next day. They met at an Irish pub in Moscow, and Blaine, clearly impressed by Felix's mastery of Russian and his easy access to Russian military officials, proceeded to tell Sater that he worked for the U.S. government, the Defense Intelligence Agency. The people Sater had been sitting with the previous night were, Blaine said, extremely high-level Russian intelligence operatives, very strong people, people who can deliver the things that America needs. They seem to like you. You speak Russian, you blend in there, and your country needs you. Blaine then asked Felix to work as a confidential source for the Defense Intelligence Agency, but gave him a stern warning. "I want you to understand," he said, "if you're caught, the USA is going to disavow you, and at best, you get a bullet in the head." Felix thought about it for 5 seconds. Having the opportunity to serve my country and do anything in its defense was a no-brainer. It was, where do I sign up? And so began Felix's second career. His most notable early operation took place in 1998, when he went on the hunt for Stinger anti-aircraft missiles that the CIA had originally given to the Mujahideen for use against the Soviets during their occupation of Afghanistan, but which were at risk of falling into the hands of radical jihadists. Felix went to work. His attorney, Robert Wolf, called David Kendall, then President Bill Clinton's lawyer, and told him that Sater had serial numbers for the Stinger missiles the Clinton administration had sought. After President Clinton was informed, Wolf then spoke to CIA General Counsel Robert M. McNamara, Jr., and read out the serial numbers of the Stingers. But the CIA was still skeptical. Next, Felix provided photographs of the missiles with their serial numbers and a copy of a daily newspaper to show the photo was contemporaneous. Meanwhile, Wolf began extended talks with two men in the CIA's clandestine division about Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden, and the Stinger missiles. When President Clinton authorized the August 1998 bombing strike against Al-Qaeda in retaliation for the terrorist bombings of the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania, BuzzFeed reported no fewer than 10 current and former intelligence and law enforcement officials said Sater supplemented U.S. intelligence by providing location coordinates for Al-Qaeda camps that the U.S. military ultimately bombed in Khost, Afghanistan. There was much more. Sater reportedly helped the FBI find dealers in New York's 47th Street Diamond District who were laundering money for Al-Qaeda and took part in other daring spy missions. After he started trying to track down the Stinger missiles, he began developing sources in Afghan intelligence and Russian intelligence. He is even said to have been involved in North Korea's nuclear program. I was given photographs of the North Korean military intel operative who was out there buying various components to build a nuclear weapons program, said Sater. He sent me intel photos, surveillance photos, as well as photos of him sitting in restaurants, of him sitting in front of the North Korean Army choir, with the instructions that this is the man that needs to be put a tail on. Meanwhile, in late 1998, the FBI responded to a tip from New York police and broke into a Manhattan storage locker, where they discovered a shotgun, two pistols, and a gym bag full of documents tied to Sater. Immediately, the FBI's Russian Organized Crime Task Force began hunting for Sater, who happened to be vacationing in Italy. He already had developed close ties to an intelligence officer with the Northern Alliance, the anti-Al-Qaeda Afghan militia led by Ahmad Shah Massoud, who BuzzFeed reported called him with precious information. He had five satellite phone numbers belonging to Osama bin Laden, and he wanted Sater to pass the numbers along to U.S. intelligence. Then the FBI found Sater and told him he was under investigation for the pump-and-dump scam. I never intended on fighting, and I surrendered, he said. I knew I was going to cooperate. And so Felix Sater became an informant not just for the CIA and DIA, but for the FBI as well, providing, according to former Attorney General Loretta Lynch, information crucial to the conviction of more than 20 people. Moreover, in return, Sater managed to negotiate an immunity deal that allowed him to stay out of jail, pay a small fine of $25,000, and emerge relatively unscathed with a sealed criminal record. Sater was not even forced to pay restitution. And finally, even though the scam reportedly involved the Russian mafia, all of that was kept secret because Felix's files were sealed. The terms of the deal were so favorable that the matter came up during Loretta Lynch's confirmation hearings for Attorney General in 2015. Lynch explained that Sater had provided information crucial to national security and the conviction of over 20 individuals, including those responsible for committing massive financial fraud and members of the Cosa Nostra. Then, on September 11, 2001, everything changed. Terrorists hijacked four airliners, crashing two of them into New York's World Trade Center and one into the Pentagon. Nearly 3,000 people were dead. The FBI, which had focused so much attention on the Italian mafia in the past, now shifted its attention to a new enemy. The Italian mafia was yesterday's news, and resources were now directed to fighting radical Islamist terrorism. As for the Russian mafia, it was barely on the FBI's radar screen. Meanwhile, the tragedy of 9/11 had made Felix's contacts far, far more valuable than ever before. From now on, Felix Sater would be the FBI's best friend. But to the rest of the world, by 2002, he had moved on and become managing director of a New York-based real estate development company called the Bayrock Group. Finally, with Felix Sater, there was always the possibility that the best stories of all were still untold. Chapter 13. Bayrock. Officially, Bayrock was the heartwarming immigrant success story of its Kazakhstan-born founder and chairman, Tevfik Arif, who graduated from the Moscow Institute of Trade and Economics and worked in the Soviet Commerce and Trade Ministry before running an export-import business, building hotels in Turkey, and moving to New York, where he developed property in Brooklyn. With the flags of the United States, Turkey, and Kazakhstan conspicuously on display in his office, Arif projected the image of a cosmopolitan international businessman who had fulfilled the American dream. Boasting more than $2.5 billion in investments in luxury waterfront resort, hotel, residential, retail, and office space developments, Bayrock had hired renowned architects to design new projects in New York, Europe, the Mediterranean, and elsewhere. The icing on the cake, in terms of Bayrock's marketing identity, could be articulated in one word, Trump. Trump was ready to license his name to Bayrock and other developers to build luxury condos in Panama City, Panama, Toronto, Canada, Baku, Azerbaijan, Kiev, Ukraine, Moscow, and many more places all over the world. Judging from its 28-page presentation materials, one would think Bayrock was one of the most successful real estate development companies in the world. Among its projects, Bayrock planned to build the Trump Soho in New York, the Trump International Hotel and Tower in Fort Lauderdale, the Trump Las Olas in Fort Lauderdale, and the Trump International Hotel and Residences in Phoenix. And that was just the United States. As a coda to its presentation, its star-studded list of strategic partners was topped with the name The Trump Organization, and a photo of Bayrock founder Tevfik Arif standing shoulder to shoulder with Donald Trump. That was Bayrock, or at least the image Bayrock projected. But the reality was much more complex. Bayrock, through its business practices, brought into Donald Trump's orbit a host of oligarchs and alleged mobsters involved in laundering money, the trafficking of underage women, feeding intelligence to the Russians, and more. In court records from a lawsuit by former employees, it is alleged Bayrock was covertly mob-owned and operated, backed by oligarchs and money the oligarchs stole from the Russian people, and engaged in the businesses of financial institution fraud, tax fraud, partnership fraud, human trafficking, child prostitution, statutory rape, and on occasion real estate. Bayrock is no longer active as a real estate development company and now exists only as a legal entity engaged in ongoing litigation, of which a spokesperson said the firm disputes all such allegations. Nevertheless, Bayrock had many of the attributes that one might find in a center of operations affiliated with the Russian mafia. That was of special interest, given that its key partner was the future president of the United States. Trump was first introduced to Bayrock by the late Tamir Sapir, the penniless Soviet emigre turned billionaire who became, in Trump's words, great friends with Trump himself, and who introduced Trump to Tevfik Arif, the founder of Bayrock, a.k.a. Tevfik Arifov. On paper, at least, Arif's story was another stirring rags-to-riches saga. In 2002, after becoming a successful real estate developer in Brooklyn, he moved Bayrock's offices to Trump Tower, where he and his staff of mostly Russian emigres set up shop on the 24th floor. When Arif and Sater helped put together several prospective Trump Tower licensing deals for sites including Moscow, Warsaw, Istanbul, and Kiev, Trump was ecstatic. Thanks to Bayrock, he could bring franchising to high-end condos. He could be the Colonel Sanders of luxury high-rises. "It was almost like mass production of a car," Trump crowed. For some projects, he boasted, he would get up to a 25% stake, plus management fees and a possible percentage of the gross, without having to invest a dime. Trump worked closely with Bayrock on real estate ventures in Russia, Ukraine, and Poland. When it came to financing them, however, he was still so toxic after Atlantic City that he left matters of funding to his new partners. Bayrock knew the investors, he later testified. Arif brought the people up from Moscow to meet with Trump. Altogether, Bayrock's leadership, as portrayed in its presentation materials, was a cozy family of billionaire oligarchs from the former Soviet Union. In fact, the extent to which various Bayrock partners actually came through with financing is unclear, but according to Bayrock's promotional literature, Arif turned to fellow Kazakh billionaire Alexander Mashkevich and his Eurasian Natural Resources Corporation, or Eurasian Group, as it is called in Bayrock's promotional literature, which he controls with Patokh Shodiev and Alijan Ibragimov, among others, to finance Bayrock. Even though he was referred to on Bayrock's website, Patokh Shodiev has denied any connection to Donald Trump, the Trump Organization, or Bayrock Group. Similarly, a person close to Mashkevich told Bloomberg that Mashkevich never invested in Bayrock. Together, the three men, known as the Trio, are major stockholders in the Eurasian Natural Resources Corporation and control chromium, alumina, and gas operations in Kazakhstan, which adds up to about 12% of the industrial production in the entire country. In June 2005, many of them came together when Arif celebrated his 52nd birthday at the grand opening of the seven-star Rixos Hotel in Belek, on the Turkish Riviera near Antalya. Guests came from all over the world, St. Petersburg, the Côte d'Azur, Ukraine, Latvia, Israel, and Moscow, traveling by yacht and private jet. This was no run-of-the-mill gathering. There were huge mounds of caviar, food, drink, and song. Among the honored guests was then Prime Minister of Turkey, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who later became president. There were professional hockey stars, Moscow restaurateurs, and billionaires from all over the world. In all, Bayrock's promotional literature boasted that it had seven billionaires affiliated with the company in one way or another. Among them was Tamir Sapir, who arrived on the Mister, his 160-foot yacht, which has been described as the most beautiful private vessel in the world. Alexander Mashkevich cruised in on his yacht, the Lady Lara, which was nearly twice as big at 299 feet. Not all the Bayrock billionaires could make it, but one extremely high-profile tycoon in New York who couldn't attend made sure that his presence was felt anyway. So on Tevfik Arif's birthday, the familiar image of Donald Trump suddenly appeared on a big-screen video conference call for the entire party to see. "Tevfik is my friend," Trump said. "Let's drink to Tevfik." By this time, Trump was indeed in the midst of a phoenix-like rebirth, both personally and professionally. His turbulent tabloid marriage to Marla Maples, his second wife, had come to an end, and he had married his third wife, Melania Knaus, a model from Slovenia, in January 2005, in a suitably extravagant wedding on his Mar-a-Lago estate that was attended by celebrities including Shaquille O'Neal and P. Diddy, then-Senator Hillary Clinton, and former President Bill Clinton. And when it came to real estate, Trump's new paradigm was taking off like wildfire. He was all over Bayrock's promotional literature, but he had nothing to do with financing and few development responsibilities. The larger point was that Trump had created a new model where he was paid to put his name on major development projects. "He's a marketing genius," Adam Rose, president of Rose Associates, which manages more than 14,000 apartments, told the New York Times. "He's gotten to the point where he can license his name." And license he did, lending his name to projects like Trump University, a real estate training program that turned out to be not a university at all, but a gigantic high-pressure bait-and-switch scam that preyed upon the elderly and uneducated to separate them from their money, as one affidavit from a former salesman for Trump University put it. In 2016, Trump denied wrongdoing but agreed to pay $25 million to Trump University students who had filed a class action suit. New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman called it a major victory for the over 6,000 victims of his fraudulent university. In addition to various projects in development with Bayrock, Trump signed a deal to license his name for an 813-unit condo project called Trump Towers in Sunny Isles Beach, Florida, a barrier island north of Miami Beach.